Let me share just very briefly. In fact, let me get my watch out here so I can time this. We're supposed to end on time. Four clergy trying to do this. That could be tough. So we're aiming to end on time. I am an Episcopal clergy. I'm presently the dean and president of one of our seminaries, General Theological Seminary in New York City. But before that, for 30 years, I served in congregations as a parish pastor. And I have to say that when I began, I did what so many clergy do. I had people that called me at 2 a.m. in the morning. Y'all ever, anybody here ever call a clergy person at 2 a.m. in the morning? Shame on you. That fed my ego. I mean, I said, oh, they care about me, and they want me to help, and they're in trouble, and they need help. And I would get up, and I would drive over, and we would spend an hour talking about how awful their husbands were, or how their children were causing so much trouble, or how the job was terrible. And the next morning, I'd call them back up and see how they were doing, and they didn't even remember I'd been there. I could make excuses for people. I would just assume, well, you know, that was a tough night, and they were in trouble, so of course they didn't remember all that. Or when somebody have a car accident, I would say, you know, they've had a tough week, and the job's just not going. I could do the excuse. I was as good an enabler. You know, clergy are helpful. And I was one of those. I had been a priest about 10 years and came into a parish in a blue-collar community. And suddenly, members of my parish were taking their check on Friday and not getting home with it, but stopping at a bar on the way home, getting in a fight, and calling me from the jail on Saturday morning with no money. And I thought that was a little unacceptable. And I began to see marriages coming apart, and that felt painful. And I said, I think this is something I don't know much about, and I need to learn. So I was sharing with someone the other day, and they said, so you went to the experts, right? I did. I went to AA meetings. I started going to AA meetings. I started getting some education. And the University of Louisville, which is where I was, had a fabulous educational program, an annual conference for clergy and alcoholism. And I started going to those. I took a couple of courses there. And I began to have my eyes open. And I came to realize that probably at a minimum 60% and probably closer to 80% of the people who called me with problems and struggles of pastoral care had addiction somewhere in the background. Sometimes it was their own. More likely it was a loved one or a child or a parent. Sometimes it was the job. But once I began my eyes open, I discovered that this is a real problem and we need to respond to it with knowledge. And I came to understand that there really is no middle ground. Either one is an enabler or one is a helper. And there's no place in between. And we will talk about this some more in this workshop. But I think too often the clergy are the helpers in the enabling sense, not in the sense of knowledge about alcoholism. But I'll talk some more about that. First, let me turn this over now to Dr. Edward Reddy.
First of all, I've seen a whole bunch of you who have known me over the years in my professional role and have never seen me wearing one of these. There are a couple people here from the parish that I serve in on weekends who have never seen me in a tie, so it's a little bit different. How I got involved in the field, I'm a gold person. Which, when I got this, I said, oh, I must be special, you know? When I first got in the field when I was in seminary, it was before ordination. And I belonged to the Diocese of Paterson, which is in northern New Jersey. And the diocese has a treatment center that was founded in 1955 to treat alcoholism and drug abuse. And in 1955, it was licensed as a hospital by the state of New Jersey, but only to treat alcoholism. So we were really, really in the forefront of everything. There was a priest who had founded the agency who was what we now know as an ACOA, who ended up dying in a tractor accident. and the place was kind of up in the air with no director. Another priest was put in charge, and he knew that in seminary I was interested in setting up kind of the new, this was back in the 60s, folks. The hair was down to here. I had the motorcycle, okay? That I was interested in new approaches to religious education. So he found out that the old priest who had died had the religious program for the treatment center was memorizing the Baltimore Catechism. Apparently there are a few old Catholics here. And he wanted something a little more up to date, so he asked me as a student to come in and set up something new. So I was doing all the group therapy stuff and all that sort of thing, and we were doing things. But before I got there, I realized I didn't know anything from Shinola about alcoholics, except what my culture had taught me. Now, the coincidence was, across the street from the building, which during Prohibition was one of Dutch Schultz's illegal breweries, okay, which had become a detox unit, across the street was a three-story kind of tenement house where my father's aunt used to live. And when I was like 5 years old, we used to go and visit Aunt Kate. And we used to peek out the window of her apartment and look into the building across the street to see Father Wall's alkies. That was my experience with alcoholism. So I get to the place and I figure, the ego didn't have certain controls built in yet. I figured, I got to show these folks that I can identify with the area. So in the course of things, I explained that, oh yeah, I know the area pretty well. My aunt used to live in that house, right up on the third floor over there. What I didn't know was that since she had died, it had become a whorehouse. And I'm so proud of the fact that my aunt used to live there. That's when I learned you don't make up stories to impress people in AA. So here I am as a grad student in an internship starting to work with alcoholics. And I'll tell you, they may have been addicted to alcohol and in the other programs, some other drugs. I can't tell you how quick it was, but I got addicted to recovering people like that. Okay. Later on, I found out it was some of my codependency that was reflected. We all have degrees in codependency. And what happened is I really started to tune in to the recovery process and the steps. And the next thing I knew, all of my term papers in theology were getting related to the steps and to the traditions of AA. Now, the seminary didn't know that I was sneaking out every day to go to the rehab center. I was only supposed to be there one day a week. I had an apartment there. I used to get back to the seminary at 5:30 in the morning, and they thought I got up early to go to chapel. About a month before ordination, I got called on the carpet, as they say. And the assistant dean said, "We heard you were out three nights last week." So, okay. They had no idea I was living at the other place. Okay. So I didn't lie. I just told them, yes, I was out three nights last week. About a month after I graduated, I started teaching at the seminary. And I started teaching courses in alcoholism counseling and that sort of things for students. And among the things that I started to learn was when dealing with clergy, and in terms of this workshop, getting to clergy that are already clergy, that's good. If you want to be most effective, get to them while they're still in formation. Because something happens once in our tradition, they lay hands on your head. Once that happens, a lot of people stop learning. And if you can get them while they're still in formation, then what you're teaching them becomes part of their ongoing ministry, not an add-on. And I'll tell you, I had students coming in for little internships with us and in class that to this day will call me up and tell me, I'm so glad I took that course because I was able to do this, I was able to do that, and it was all because of little teeny things. You know, parishioners that are here from the church where I go didn't go to my Mass last Sunday, so but I saw them afterwards. But at the end of the Mass, I wanted to see if anybody was coming here. So I said, most of you are not going to understand this announcement, but if there's any friends of Bill Wilson here, please see me after Mass. So most of the people I knew and a few others showed up and wanted to see who was coming, and nobody was at that Mass, but the next Mass, well, they started showing. But just saying things like that lets people know that the clergyman knows something about recovery in the process. One of the tips that I used to give the students was, when you first get into a parish, in one of your sermons, just mention that you know that you're going to run into the problem of alcoholism. So if there are any members that do 12-step work, please contact me privately. One of my students did that the first week he was there. He did not have time to do anything else. He had to start a noontime meeting at the parish because he couldn't get anything done. People kept coming and wanting help. And just by saying that, he had a meeting that within a month had 30 people bringing their lunch bags. Okay? But you got to get them in training. Okay? There is another crowd that we all know. They got into recovery after ordination. They kind of learned the hard way. Okay? These folks, by the way, have a real tough time because all the stigma that goes along with the addictions, when it comes to clergy, it's the same thing. One of the places I help out with is a rehab center for nuns, for Catholic nuns. There's really two in the country, and this was the first one. And, boy, you know, I never met shame and guilt more than the fallen virgin. Okay? And those ladies have taught me so much about dealing with issues of forgiveness and understanding how to process that and how to get their self-respect back and learning the sacrament of recovery. Okay. There's another group out there that's a big group to look into, and certain people are good at this. Once you got a clergyman, if you can get them going for postgraduate education and learn some counseling, that's a good time to get them introduced into the recovery process. Okay, I used to do that at Seton Hall Seminary. I've done it at a few other places with clergy. That's a really good time to do that. Then there's clergy who show up at their parish assignment or their community assignment, and all of a sudden they start making contact with recovering people who they never knew one before. And they start seeing the transformation in life that took place, and they become hooked. First, they become intrigued. They start showing up at open meetings, finding out that there's more parishioners there than they thought. And they found out that if AA wasn't there, their collections would not be as good as they are. Okay. But getting into that group before they're ordained, before they're assigned, I can't express the importance of that. Now, some of my pet peeves. One of the things that drives me stark raving nuts when I go to meetings is when people say things like, I'm a recovering Catholic. I'm a recovering Baptist. Yeah, I get it. But what that tells other clergy is that other clergy don't want to get involved with this group because they're going to take people away from my congregation. And when clergy hear that, if they really don't understand what they're talking about, it becomes a barrier for that clergyman to understand the recovery process. Another thing, and this goes back to prohibition and pre-prohibition, the business about the sinfulness of alcoholism, that still shows up a lot. Okay? And we need to really push the fact, and I think we got good solid material in the big book and in the program, that this is a treatable disease. People can recover from the disease. And making that separation between sinfulness and disease is a really, really important thing. The other phrase that's a pet peeve problem is religion is for people who are afraid of hell, and spirituality is for those who have been there. Oh, come on. That, you know. Excuse me, John, but if you've never had a bishop, you don't know what hell can be. Okay? That is only surpassed by one other statement, and I almost hit people when I hear this one. When they're talking about higher power, please don't ever say that a doorknob can be your higher power. My God gets very upset when she hears that. My doctoral project I did on understanding and assessing spiritual health in the treatment of addictions. And I took a very positive approach to spirituality and health rather than the sickness model. And when I was proposing the project, I said that I wanted to do this from the perspective of a theistic understanding of recovery and a non-theistic understanding of recovery, the agnostics and atheists. And I had a Jesuit who was my project director. And Jesuits are usually pretty cool. Yeah. And he says, "What do you mean atheist and pastoral counseling?" I said, "Well, it's the spirituality issues," and I started going into all that. And he said, "It doesn't make any sense. I'm going to have to get this cleared by the university and all that." And finally we did. But the way I got in tune with that, I was asked to give a retreat once. And whenever I'm asked to give a retreat, I always say, first of all, you got to know I'm not in AA. Everybody assumes since I've been in the field so long that I am. And I said, I'm not. And they said, "Oh, that's okay. We're not a regular group either." So I said, "Well, you're a 12-step group, right?" You see, I said, "AA? Well, some of us. NA? Some of us. GA? Some of us. Al-Anon? Some of us." Everything was some of us. So I said, "Oh, so you're a mixed group." "No, we have one thing in common. We're all atheists and agnostics." And I had to prepare a retreat without using the God word. And that really helped me refine a lot of thinking about the difference between religion and spirituality. And I think we need to be careful to make sure that we respect people who are still suffering, who are having a tough time with the God word. Okay? And I think there's a lot of folks out there and a lot of good religious folks who know how to make that distinction. But it's something that members in general really have to learn to respect as well. Okay? A lot of the 12-step history includes a lot of Christian stuff. And for non-Christians, that becomes a barrier sometimes. So we need to be really, really careful how we do that. There are some new groups, and I was going to mention Jack's, but I'm sure we'll hear something about Jack's in a moment. But there's a lot of good Buddhist stuff out there. There's a group with Islam as their faith tradition, Malati Islami, headquartered in Baltimore, where they take the steps and they kind of integrate it in with Islamic teaching. It's a way to open up the steps to people who otherwise might not notice. And I think we need to be open to that and be aware of it and not be afraid of it. There's something about the steps that we all have to recognize. The steps are a uniquely American approach to spirituality. It was invented here. Most of the other forms of spirituality come from Europe and Asia and all that. This is really ours. And one of the things that makes it ours is that it's non-denominational. It's interreligious. It transcends religious tradition. And we want to, you know, we've all got our religious beliefs. I have a few. Yeah. We need to keep them, because when you add the spirituality to healthy religion, you get a really good effect. Okay? Now, if you put spirituality with bad religion, things get ugly. But let's not put down traditional religious, because there's a really good thing, there's some really good stuff to learn from the ancient religious traditions that really do not interfere, that in fact they really complement the steps very, very well. I'm giving up.
Thank you, Ed. As I was beginning to learn about alcoholism and changing my own life about how I responded and interacted with those who were suffering symptoms from this disease, I've been going to meetings maybe 3 or 4 years, and a member of my congregation by the name of Willie walked into my office, and he said, "Ward, you're the spiritual expert, right?" Try to answer that question. I don't remember answering it, but he went on quickly, and he said, "I am out of touch with God. And the last time I was out of touch with my higher power, I drank. And if I drink again, I may die. I need you to put me back in touch with God." So we talked a little while, and out of that conversation, we decided that what we needed, and I think Ed was referring to it, when people come into AA, often they have been treated badly. By the church, judged, pushed out, condemned, all sorts of ways, enabled even. But the church has been a hindrance, not a help. And even hearing God language in AA is difficult for some. And so you can't get into struggles with theological questions at that point. It's just not time. And we decided we would have a group of, and today I would call it an 11th step group, but I didn't know about 11 step groups then, of people who had at least 5 years of sobriety, and we would meet and talk about any issue in your spiritual life that was of concern. And that was the agenda. And for the next 5 years, I met with that group every Tuesday afternoon, every week, every month, and the spiritual expert's life was transformed. That's where I began to know the steps at a much deeper level. That's where I began to work the steps for my own spirituality. I've always considered Willie my first sponsor. And the steps have become the foundation for my own spiritual life. In my present job, being head of a small school means that you have all of the responsibilities and duties of a large school, but no staff. And theological schools today are extremely challenged, both financially and programmatically. And it has been a very difficult job. And I do not believe I could be doing this job if it had not been for that experience and for that beginning and foundation in the 12 steps. On my computer, my screensaver says one day at a time, first things first. And the number of times that has helped me get centered again is probably more than once a day. And it has been that focus on mission, a support group that has always included members of this fellowship that have allowed me to do the job that I've been able to do. This program, I know this program has a single purpose, but I'm glad that I was able to get something a little bit even beyond that purpose of staying sober today, a kind of strength and power that has changed my life. And enabled me to minister in ways I never could have otherwise. This is an incredibly, wonderfully supportive, powerful spiritual program, and I thank you for sharing that with me. With this, we want to move to Rabbi Yehoshua Kaganov. Thank you.
Okay, got a timer? Okay. Okay. At Jax, I start like this. My name is Kaganov, and I'm a rabbi. You don't know what an honor it is for me to standing at this podium. I'm blown away by the magnitude of seeing so many people in recovery in one place. Last night, when I walked into Hall A and saw what was going on, my knees began wobbling. Really, I felt faint. The greatest thing, of course, when I landed at San Antonio Airport, had a reception committee. Right? People with the green T-shirts, friends of Bill W., I felt at home. So I want to thank God, if that's okay using his word, his name, her name, his name. Okay, and of course, the General Services Board of AA, they've been extremely accommodating to me. As you can see, I'm an ultra-Orthodox Jew. I have all come with a whole bunch of baggage. And Rick Walker from the office has been, Rick, and the whole organization has been extremely accommodating to make sure I feel at home. And it's really, really, it's a testament to the tolerance, the acceptance. You know, you're okay even though you're different than me, which is a far cry from where I'm coming from. And that's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. So when Rick called me about 5-6 weeks ago and asked me if I would speak, I said, listen, you got to help me. What am I supposed to do here? He said, why don't you just tell us about how you got involved in 12-step program? I said, that's a good idea. It should be pretty easy. It's harder than I thought getting up here, but maybe once I get into it, it'll go a little easier. For the first 35 years of my life, so I was the way you see me now, that's how I grew up. And of course, it was understood, Jews don't drink and drug. Of course not. I mean, after all, the great philosopher of the 18th century, Immanuel Kant, he wrote it. It's in his philosophy works. Jews have a peculiar characteristic in nature that they just, they can take alcohol and it doesn't affect them because of the religious overtones of what they, what a bunch of nonsense. But if you want to be in denial, Immanuel Kant, the great hat to hang your, you know, hook the hat up. So I formally took my first pulpit about age 35. It was in Philadelphia at the time. When I arrived at the scene, so the president of the congregation told me that one of the mainstays of the community is an alcoholic. He's the guy that's doing everything in the congregation. You know, you can get the community. Right, the congregation, he's there. He's on the board of education of all the schools. You know, he's on the board of the synagogue. You know these guys, right? He's also an alcoholic. So I said, okay, so. He said, okay, you should be aware. When it comes, alcohol. You know, when it comes partying time, like, the fall we have a rejoicing of the Torah celebration, he'll get, and then there's Purim in the spring, and he's going to get plastered, and he's going to do things that are not so nice, and say things that are not so nice, and that's all. We live with it. That's all. Because Jews don't drink, of course, you know. If any of you know the term mashiker, right? So mashiker doesn't belong to the Jewish people, right? That's it. This doesn't happen. Okay, let's move 10 years forward. This is the winter of 95. Okay, so the day after, Purim is a holiday in the spring for the Jewish people. It's about a month before Passover. It commemorates in a time when the Jews were saved en masse from annihilation. So there is something about, you know, celebrating. So the day afterwards, I get called by a member of the congregation. He wants to speak to the rabbi. What? Okay. No, I can't speak to you in the chapel. I can't speak to you here. I need to go downstairs in a private area. Okay, takes me downstairs. No, that's not good enough. Takes me to the boiler room. Behind the boiler. Right? All the way in the corner of the boiler room. No one should, God forbid, hear. So he tells me, now this mainstay, it's not just, this is a neighbor. He says, Rabbi, I don't know if you know, Chaim, we'll call him Chaim, right? It's a pseudonym. Chaim's a drunk. I said, so what? The president told me that 10 years ago. What do now? Okay, this past winter, there were a lot of ice storms in Philadelphia. And his wife was dutifully cleaning off the car from the ice so they could move. And he's standing at the front door screaming at her all sorts of expletives. Okay? And I said, and so he says, we can't take it anymore. We're neighbors. We know what goes on all the time, but we just can't take it. I said, okay. And? Well, you're the rabbi. Fix it. Fix it? What in the nation's name am I supposed to do with that? So the good Lord has strange ways. It happens to be that the Rabbi Dr. Abe Twersky, some of you may know his name, yeah, a little bit, okay, Rabbi Dr. Abe Twersky, who happens to be, for those who don't know his name, so he's one of the biggest experts in addictions in the world, famous person. His rabbiship, his ordination, comes from my grandfather. My grandfather ordained him. So we always had a relationship. The family knew each other. There was a relationship. So I was not uncomfortable calling him up, and I said, Rabbi Twersky, I'm Kagan Arthur. Oh, whose son are you? Who's, you know, grandson? Okay, how does it work? So I identified myself, and we did our Jewish geography stuff, and then... And then he said, okay, well, so what gives me this plus? I said, listen, I got this guy Chaim, who's a pillar of the community, and he knew who he was, because from a famous family. He knew exactly who he was. He says, he's an alcoholic. He says, oh, you want to help? Okay. So I'm overnighting to you one of my books, which is out of print, Caution, Kindness Can Be Dangerous to the Alcoholic. Great chapter on pastors and clergy in that one, about us being enablers. The book was an eye-opener. Get Vernon Johnson's book, another clergyman who's big in the name, Intervention, all right? And we'll put you in touch with an interventionist, okay? So we began meetings with this interventionist, and we started doing what we need to preparation for an intervention. 5-6 weeks later, we did the intervention. It was a fiasco. You know, we had all the best. Chaim bolted. He saw I was in the room. He ran. But his older brother tackled him. And then they were in a room together for half an hour. We're all sitting there, the 15-20 people who had arranged it. We were all sitting there waiting, and we were hearing voices going on in that room. All of a sudden, the brother sticks his head out of the room, and he says, Kagan, I'll get out of here. He'll kill you. Get everyone out also. He's going. He's going. All right? He's going. We're taking my car. We had arranged Father Martin's Ashley. He's going to Father Martin's Ashley. Okay? You go with the wife in the car behind. Okay? All right? So, make a long story short, because I'm going to run out of time. Each of these stories I can tell will take an hour themselves. And went to Father Martin's Ashley. He stayed over a major holiday, Shavuos, Pentecost, by us. A major holiday. He stayed there, which is unheard of. 5 weeks later, he pops himself out. How much time do I have? How much time? 10 more minutes. Okay, because this is not the main part of the story. Okay. So I better speed up. Okay. 5 weeks later, he plops himself down in my office, opposite me, and he goes, now what? Get a load of this killer. Get a load of this one. Okay. I said, well, you went to rehab. You recovered. The ignorance is outrageous. Anyway, so I see it's not cutting it. I said, I'm not getting through. I pick up the phone. I call Dr. Abe, and I say to Rabbi Twersky, I said, Chaim's back. What do I do now? Oh, Yehoshua, I forgot to tell you. By the way, that's the name. Yehoshua. Okay. It's an impossible name, I know, but I was told that in recovery I should use Kaganoff for that reason. So, where was I here? Yeah, so, oh, Yehoshua, you want to help? You really want to help? I've got to tell you, you're in it for life. Get to some AA meetings. Start doing the steps. Find out if you have a Jack's meeting in Philadelphia. If not, get to a Jack's retreat. What's Jack's? Jack's? Play with a ball in the What's Jack's? As grateful as I am to God and to AA, my gratitude really goes to Jax. Jax taught me. They taught me about this disease. They really did. Jax is an organization started in New York, has branches many places and international as well. stands for Jewish Alcoholics, Chemically Dependent Persons, and Significant Others. I know there are more letters and acronyms, but that's how it works. JACS, Jewish Alcoholics, the C is for Chemically Dependent Persons, and Significant Others. Okay? At the end of my presentation, I was going to say, but I mean, I get this. I better say it now. Okay? I want any and all my Jewish brothers and sisters sitting here in the audience or at this convention or anywhere in the world who have a problem with substances, alcohol, to know, okay, that as a Jew, you're not alone. And there's an organization, and I have literature here. Actually, there should have been 5 members of the committee here in the room, but because the fire marshal, they're out in the hall. But Vicky's here, and Lisa's here, Sylvie's here, Karen, Gitti, Chaya, actually, the 6 of them. All right, they're here, too, because and I was hopeful that I could have them stand up. You know who they are, because sometimes Jews are embarrassed or don't know. How do we connect spirituality to Jewish tradition? How do we do such a thing? Right? It's a big deal. It's a problem. It was mentioned before by one of the other speakers. But not only is it doable, they dovetail perfectly. All right, in my 15 years now, I'm reluctant to say I'm in recovery because I don't work the program anywhere near any of you do. Okay, so I'm a combination of an Al-Anon. Recently, I was told by my mentor, I'm an Al-Anonian. That's who I am. But as I said, I work 3 programs at once. I work the AA, I work the Al-Anon, and I work the ACA or ACOA, depending what part of the country you come from. Depending on who's sitting, who's calling from the other side of the phone, or who's sitting on the other side of the room from me. Okay, so I put different hats on because I need to help the people depending on what I identify as their issues, their core issues, what are their basic issues. Okay, let me get back to the story. So when Chaim came back, all right, Chaim to this day is sober. He's dry. Not sober. He's not sober, okay, and here's the codependence coming out. Okay, it's my fault, right, because I didn't rescue him. So I've learned since then that I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it, whatever the 3 C's are. There's a 4th C they put in there too. But I didn't get it in time for him, but the next one, that summer, all right, this is the summer 95, I identified a woman, young woman, 3 young children, Sephora we'll call her. She was driving carpool, stoned out of her mind. She liked vodka because it doesn't leave anything on the breath. Smirnoff, okay. So, together with her husband, we did an intervention that summer on her. And this time I didn't do any fancy interventionist. I did it myself with the husband. We got her to go off to rehab. She went for a couple of weeks. Following year was a story of slipping and sliding all over the place, in and out, back and forth, right? Some other time I'll tell you some of the real wild stories I went through with her. Following summer, enough was enough. The husband came to me and said, listen, it's not sticking. We did a second intervention on her. And she attempted suicide when I left the building. That was the greatest thing to happen to her at that time because she failed me. That's why she tried to overdose, but she wasn't successful. She was hospitalized for a week. That gave us enough time to make arrangements. She went out to Pittsburgh to Rabbi Abe's Gateways in Pittsburgh, outside of Pittsburgh, whatever you pronounce the name. And she came back 5 weeks later. All right, she had been inpatient for 3 weeks or so, about 6 weeks she was away. She came back in late August. And when she came back, she brought me a gift. You recognize it? So 12 and 12. So my date of recovery, clean day, whatever you want to call it, day of sobriety, would be sometime in September of 96. Okay? Dr. Torsi said, get to a retreat. Sephora wanted to go to a retreat, so that fall was my first JACS retreat. We went to a JACS retreat, and boy, did I have an explosion. Okay? Come on, man. That's not spirituality. Come on, religion is spirituality. This is not spirituality. What is this? Oh, boy, did I have a hard time. And I wrote a scathing letter to Rabbi Tversky. Who the heck are you kidding? And he wrote me back a letter and said, oh, really? And who do you think you're kidding? And I learned to shut up and listen. And the first JACS retreat, I'm surprised they invited me back for a second one, but they did. And by the following year, right, the following year, that would be 97, JACS asked me to present to the audience and do a workshop on the 12 traditions and Judaism. Rabbi Abe had actually done, and it's online, right? It's the 12 steps in Judaism. How the 12 steps of AA are fully compatible with traditional Jewish Torah, frummy, for those who know the term, right? Super religious, right? Observance. It's not a contradiction at all. At all. They asked me to do the traditions. I did, and I brought the house down. Is that arrogant? But I have learned in the course of recovery that sometimes telling the truth is not arrogance, but factual. You need to know, and I need to know, right? I was able to show and demonstrate. And since then, I've lectured on it a number of times. It's recorded, and if you would like to get a hold of, you know, how Judaism fits with the 12 steps or the 12 traditions, I have lectures on it. It's available. Again, self-promotion, right? There you go. But I've also learned that Jews coming into recovery have an awfully difficult time. How does Judaism, especially Judaism, they watch the Jews practice? And this is where a wise man needs to be quoted. We ought not, and I got 1 minute left. Okay, we ought not confuse Judaism with Jews. Okay? Jews have a lot of baggage. All right? And some of what I've spent the last 7-8 years is figuring out, right, what's the baggage that our people are carrying. All right? And most times when people come in, it's the kids at risk, the adults at risk. It all starts from some sort of trauma or abuse in childhood. And oftentimes people's recovery doesn't stick because underlying their recovery, behind the recovery, is the trauma that needs to be resolved. Okay? But I tell them, don't fool yourself in thinking that you're going to go for therapy and that's going to do it. The 12 steps is the only known remedy to the disease of alcoholism. They're working on other things. I don't think they're going to be successful because they want to push God out. And that's a fundamental piece that we in this room understand, which I'm sorry to say, in many religious circles, they don't get. All right? God's in charge. And he wants a relationship with us. All right? And as soon as we turn to him, okay, things will start changing. All right? And so with this, I'd like to close because my time is up. And for those of you, again, my brothers and sisters, the Jewish faith, who would like to have more information, seek me out, seek the others out who are here. They're members of the JAKS organization. If you don't do that, jaksweb.org, all right? It's online. Some of my materials posted there. Rabbi Twersky's written there. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing in recovery in 12 steps that's not compatible with traditional Torah Jewish thought. Thank you very much for letting me.
Somebody. All that God talk in the lights, that could get scary. This is really humbling. You know, one of the things that is of greatest value to me in this fellowship is that we are asked to do only one thing, and that is to be ruthlessly honest. As a priest, what the church wants me to do is be good. In AA, you want me to be honest. That's why this is such an incredibly wonderful fellowship. And as you have listened, at least to the first three of us, and I'm sure you will hear the same from Bishop Guernsey, we need your help. You know, clergy do want to be helpful. We didn't get into this because we wanted to hurt people. But the level of ignorance among us is dramatic. And it is with the help of the fellowship. And that means you, some of you at least, as individuals who are parts of churches, can really be helpful to the clergy in that church. Tell them about the program. That's not breaking anonymity to do it in private. It's public where we break our anonymity. Let them know about the program, and you will know very quickly if they are receptive to learning. And if they are, get them to go to meetings with you. Open that door. It will change their life, and it will make their ministry effective in ways they could not believe. When my eyes were opened, I realized that somewhere between 60% and 80% of those who called me, somewhere in the background, close or distant, was addiction. And we need to know that, and we need to know how to respond to that. And the way it begins is by introducing the clergy to the experts, you. And there are other ways that you can be of assistance. A good example, I got a call one afternoon, a man had just been arrested at DWI, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was his third arrest. He was going to lose his license. Didn't know whether he was going to have to go to jail or not. They needed me to come out and fix it. I call a friend of mine who's in AA who had been with me before on interventions. I go out and deal with the family because I know enough about the family nature of this illness to understand that the family has got to get help. And my friend who's in the program goes and talks with the person who'd just been arrested. And that kind of intervention, I have found, is incredibly successful because they get to hear their story on your lips, and I get to tell the family to get involved in Al-Anon, go to treatment, and get help too, because it's the total family disease. It's not just that son of a bitch. I better sit down and let John, Bishop John Guernsey.
Thank you so much. It's a tremendous privilege and a joy to be here, to be at this wonderful group, and my great thanks to some of my friends and colleagues who've gotten me into this and are here to cheer me on. I'm one of those who grew up in total ignorance of AA and its message and traditions, but as was spoken of earlier in the hopeful sense, I was one of those who went to a seminary that did indeed have a special institute on alcoholism, on education and prevention of the disease and treatment, and thankfully I was led to take some of those courses. And then I had some further continuing education from the Johnson Institute, and it was at the Johnson Institute training that I heard one of my favorite stories. We were being taught about shame, and they were making the point that, you know, guilt is remorse over what you've done, but shame really cuts at who you all are, you know, feeling guilty and shame about your very being. And we were invited, believe it or not, in a group of this size, to share some of our stories of our most shameful and embarrassing moment. And one brave woman in my group stood up, and she said, "I'm an intensive care unit nurse." And she said, "We always think we're out to save the world." And I was driving home from work, and I was still wearing my scrubs, what we weren't supposed to do, but I was doing it anyway. So I guess I felt I was in full rescue mode. And I was driving home, and I came upon a scene of a horrific accident. And cars were everywhere. The police were there. The ambulance was there. All kinds of rescue people were there. And there was a guy lying in the street with a paramedic working on him doing CPR. And she said, "I knew instantly that he had no idea what he was doing." And so I slammed on the brakes. I opened the car door. I ran across. I gave the paramedic a forearm and knocked him off the guy, slammed his chest, at which point the guy sat up and somebody said, "Cut! Where did she come from?" Well, you might well look at me and wonder, you know, where did he come from? But there you are. It was at the 20th anniversary celebration of AA held in my hometown of St. Louis in 1955 that the Reverend Sam Shoemaker, an Episcopal priest from Pittsburgh, gave a historic address which he boldly entitled, "What the Church Has to Learn from AA." It was, and is, a tremendously important message, and sadly, in my experience, it's a message that is known far too little in the church today, because it's a message the church still needs to hear. Sam Shoemaker is obviously known to many of you, and known to those who've read this wonderful history of the movement. Shoemaker, as you probably know, was not an alcoholic, but he became a principal spiritual guide to those who founded and led AA in the early years. He helped build into AA biblical truth and principles. But while AA had found many of its principles in Scripture, it was Shoemaker who pointed out that all too often AA lives out those principles much better than the church does. And hence the title of his sermon, What the Church Has to Learn from AA. And now more than half a century later on this 75th anniversary, I think his insights are every bit as timely, every bit as relevant as they were when they were first spoken. And so I want to share with you some of this sermon. It's mentioned in the book. Its stunning impact is described, but the content of the message isn't given. So I'd like to do what I've done in a congregation I served for many years, and that is I want to share with you some of Shoemaker's own words and his main points, and then talk a bit about how we've sought to live out those principles in the congregation I pastored for these last 29 years, and then I want to share some personal words in closing. Now, Shoemaker's opening words probably would have shocked a few people. After his attention-getting title, he said this: I think some of you may be a little horrified at this suggestion. I fear you will be saying to yourself, what have we, who've always been decent people, to learn from a lot of reconstructed drunks? And perhaps you thereby reveal to yourself how very far you are from the spirit of Christ and the gospel, and how very much in need of precisely the kind of checkup that may come to us from AA. The text of Shoemaker's sermon was 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26, which says, God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. And he made it very clear at the outset that it's precisely when we consider ourselves wise and strong that we need to go to school under those whom we have called foolish and weak. Shoemaker drew four learnings from AA, which the church needs to recapture. First is the fact that, as he put it, nobody gets anywhere till he recognizes a clearly defined need. Those people do not come to AA to get made a little better. They do not come because the best people are doing it. They come because they are desperate. They are not ladies and gentlemen looking for a religion. They are utterly desperate men and women in search of redemption. Without what AA gives, death stares them in the face. With what AA gives, there is life and hope. There are not a dozen ways. There are not two ways. There is one way. They find it or perish. AAs each and all have a definite, desperate need. Well, in my experience in the church, all too often people blithely say, God gives you what you need. But I don't think that's true. God doesn't always give you what you need. But he does give you what you admit you need. And I think it's here that we clergy especially need to be clear about our own needs and vulnerabilities and our failings. Many clergy are alcoholics. Some are in recovery, of course, but many more hide behind the collar. Sam Shoemaker quoted a man named Jerome Ellison, who said, the relief of being accepted can never be known by one who never thought himself unaccepted. I hear of good Christian men and women belonging to fine old Christian families. There were no good Christians in the first church, only sinners. The Apostle Peter never let himself or his hearers forget his betrayal of Jesus in the hour the cock crowed. That was before there were fine old church families. Today, the last place where you can be candid about one's faults is in the church. In a bar, yes. In a church, no. I know, I've tried both places. Shoemaker commented, let that sting you and me just as it should and make us miserable with our church Phariseeism until we see it as just as definite and as hideous as anybody's drunkenness can ever be, and a great deal more morally dangerous. Second thing the church needs to learn from AA is that there are people, that people are redeemed in a life-changing fellowship. We like to say at our church that God accepts us where we are, but he doesn't leave us that way. Shoemaker pointed out that AA does not expect to let anybody who comes in stay as he is. They know he's in need and must have help. It never occurs to an AA that it's enough to have him sit down and polish his spiritual nails all by himself, or dust off his soul all by himself, or spend a couple of minutes praying each day all by himself. He gets his soul in order by trying to help other people get their souls in order with the help of God. I think one of the great spiritual perils facing us in our culture is this false notion that it's really all about us. That we just need to find ourselves and meet our own needs and do what's best for us. The New Testament church was a church that lived for others. They shared what they had. They met together for prayer. They broke bread in one another's homes. And they lived to share what the Lord was doing in them with everyone they met. And as a result, the Bible says, the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Just like AA. Our experience is that while those in recovery, of course, need to band together in AA, we also need them to be an integral part of our small groups in the church at large. The church needs AAs to bring what they understand about community life into the life of the church. And so our small groups are mixed groups, with people with a range of ages and life circumstances, some in recovery, some dealing with other challenges. This is all in addition to participating in AA. AAs know what it takes to create that life-changing fellowship, and the church needs to draw on the great strength and resources of its members who have been transformed by AA. Shoemaker described the newest member of AA this way. He may be changed today and out working tomorrow. No long, senseless delays about giving away what he's got. He's ready to give the little he has the moment it comes to him. The fellowship that redeemed him will wither and die unless he and others like him get in and keep that fellowship moving and growing by reaching others. My experience of people in recovery has been much like Shoemaker's. In my ministry, I have time and time again called on my AA friends for 12-step calls to help people in all sorts of crisis or need, and importantly, for leadership in the church in all of its ministries. AAs know how to give. And the church needs to utilize their gifts of passion and their sacrificial commitment. Number three, Shoemaker said the church needs to learn from AA the necessity for honest and direct personal dealing with people. As he put it, AAs know all the stock excuses. They've used them themselves and heard them 100 times. All the blame is put on someone else. My temperament is different. I've tried it and it doesn't work for me. I'm really not so bad. I just slip. Sometimes I've heard them all and know them for the rationalized pack of lies they are. They constitute, Shoemaker said, to get taken together, the gospel of hell and failure. I've heard them laboring with one another, now patient as a mother, now savage as a prize fighter, now careful in explanation, now pounding in a heavy personal challenge, but always knowing the desperate need and the sure answer. What great words. Shoemaker went on, are we in the church like that? We are so official, so polite, so ready to accept ourselves and each other at face value. I went for years, he said, before I ever met a man that dared to get at my real needs, create a situation which I could be honest with him and hold me to a specific Christian commitment and decision. One can find kindness and even good advice in the church, but that's not all that men need. They need to be helped to face themselves as they really are. AA people see themselves just as they are. I think many of us in the church see ourselves as we should like to appear to others. But that's not how we appear before God. We need drastic personal dealing and challenge. How many of us have ever taken a fearless moral inventory of ourselves and dared to make the depth of our need known to any other human being? This gets at the pride, which is the hindrance and sticking point for so many of us, and which for most of us in the church has never even been recognized, let alone dealt with. It's that honesty with ourselves and with one another that we've sought to put at the heart of our congregation's its spiritual and emotional healing ministry. And the indispensable requirement for honesty is one reason I think so many of us clergy sometimes hold back from the very help we need so much. We have to be willing to be transparent, to be fearless in facing the sin and the brokenness and the pain. And because we are willing to, if we are willing to submit humbly to the Lord's work, he will break through and he'll bring that healing and that freedom. And fourth, Shoemaker said, the fourth and final thing the church needs to learn from AA is the necessity for a real change of heart, a true conversion. AA, he said, is a society of the before and after with a clear line between the old life and the new. As Ward said, AAs say their public relations are based not on promotion, but on attraction. And the attraction begins when you see people with problems like your own, hear them speaking freely of the answers they're finding, and realize that such honesty and such change is exactly what you need yourself. I know in our congregation we've seen God change lives in dramatic ways, but we've had to relearn what AA has long known. that we have to give a more central place for public testimony to God's love and healing power, including and especially on Sunday mornings. It begins with the clergy. I've come to try to be as open and as transparent as I can about my own sins and failings and how God has worked emotional and spiritual healing in my life. And I believe that it's only when those of us who are in leadership are willing to be vulnerable will there be a climate of openness and acceptance in the church. And it's only in that truth-telling environment will those in recovery find a safe spiritual home. And so four learnings, which AA first took from Scripture and from the church, but which the church now needs to relearn from AA. As I've come to know and love many people in recovery, I've also come to see how the church's failure to live out these principles has deeply wounded many people. And I'm sure there are some here this morning who have felt the church has hurt you, or condemned you, or failed you, or rejected you. The Bible teaches that we should repent and turn away from our sins and ask forgiveness from God and from those we've hurt. But the Bible also teaches that we should repent and ask forgiveness for the sins of our people. For example, we might ask for forgiveness for the sins of our family, or on behalf of our community or our nation, on behalf of our ethnic group or our race or sex, on behalf of the people in our profession, or on behalf of our church. First, we have to identify with our group, then we repent and we ask for forgiveness, both from God and from those whom our group has hurt or from their representatives. And so this morning, I want to do exactly that. I'm a bishop in the church. I'm a representative leader. And in that role, I want to ask you for forgiveness for the sins of the church. I want to ask you personally, and I want to ask you as the AA community. I want to ask you for forgiveness on behalf of bishops and priests and pastors, on behalf of deacons and elders and monks and nuns, on behalf of Sunday school teachers and church members. I want to ask you for forgiveness for what sins we may have committed against you. I ask you to forgive us for abuse and betrayal, for hypocrisy and arrogance, for rejection and judgmentalism and false teaching, an ungodly behavior, a lack of personal holiness, a lack of love, a failure to have compassion for the broken, an unwillingness to learn about recovery and addiction, pride, and a refusal to acknowledge our own sin, an unwillingness to deal with our own issues while judging you for yours. For these things, and for all our sins, I am so very sorry. And I ask you, would you please forgive us? Would you please, by the grace of God, forgive us our sins against you? Today, or someday, I pray that you will find it in your heart to forgive us. May our gracious God have mercy on us all, and may he give us the grace to live another day through his strength and his love. Thank you all.